homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. How many people here, that is among the lay people who are here, would have met Reverend Master Chiyu? Okay. Not an overwhelming number. Okay. I'm Reverend Koten. I'm the prior of Lionsgate Priory in Canada. And I'm down here visiting for a few months. Actually, among the monks, too, for that matter, there would have been a number of people who had never met her either, I would imagine. She requested me to be her biographer. I have not actually written a biography, so I don't know whether... I've always wondered whether you can say you're somebody's biographer if you've never actually produced the text, because it all sounds so grand, if you know what I mean. She asked me to do so, so I'm under obligation. And I've done various research, you know, and talked about her from time to time. In the Buddhist scriptures, it says that the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, is actualized in the disciple through the kindness of the teacher. Okay? I would say that, to expand on that, it's not simply, obviously, just the encounter with one particular teacher, but it's actually the encounter with the Dharma itself. Okay, but leaving that aside, I first encountered Reverend Master Chiyu in 1976, before actually, I think at least half of you were born, for that matter. And I was not a practitioner of Zen. As a matter of fact, I believe it or not, though there was a Zen boom going on, I actually had no interest in Zen whatsoever. You know, couldn't fathom Alan Watts. I found a lot of the Zen books depressed me. Some of them still do, actually, to tell you the truth. Because from time to time, when I'm in a large bookstore, being a Zen monk officially, I feel under an obligation to look in the Zen section, even though I'm more interested in the other ones, the other Buddhist sections. And so I, you know, try out various of the books, and often I can't fathom what they're talking about. And so when I encountered Reverend Master, how do I put this? I had read a lot about Buddhism before I came here, including the stories of the life of the Buddha. And it's what drew me to practice the Dharma, practice Buddhism, was a certain flavor that came across in the life of Shakyamuni, of the historical Buddha, and a number of the teachers who came after him. And so I'm going to try to articulate this a little bit. The strong element of the encounter with the real, as opposed to what people want things to be like, encounter with the real, the common sense, if I can put it that way, and in that refreshing way whereby, how do I put it, where the Dharma is constantly causing me to turn my sense and knowledge of things completely upside down. You know, I go along for a while, I think I understand it to some degree. And then something occurs which seems to turn it all upside down. I find this experience both refreshing but also frightening. Okay? And also, I personally think it's absolutely necessary. When I encountered her, Master Jiu, it was very much the same as the characteristics that I saw in what I read about the life of the Buddha. That one is encountering something or someone who knows what reality is and therefore in the same way as when I encountered the Dharma for the first time and wanted to get inside of it, kind of like encountering a door and wanting and having the sense that behind that door there was a direct, the real, as opposed to the gray, sort of gray fog that one was used to living in. And wanting very much to get inside of that door. And then when I encountered Reverend Master, it was encountering somebody who knew not only how to open the door, because many teachers can point out the nature of reality to you. Okay. But very, very few can tell you how to enter into it, how to make it true for yourself, how all the various levels and aspects of it. And Reverend Master was very much one of those people. If you look around here, you know, these buildings, and particularly people who saw this place when it began, which was basically a collection of those stone buildings that you see, you know, all around the place. There was no cloister, none of this. For that matter, there were no scripture books, no ceremonial instructions. And all of it, even though it comes out of the hard work of the people who have lived here throughout the years, but none of us would have known how to go about it without her teaching, because we could never have done it out of a book. Okay? We could have read all the books we wanted about Buddhism, but we could never have actualized or made real this place, and for that matter, those of you who are staying for Jukai or have been to Jukai in the precepts giving before. Okay? None of that would have even appeared. Dogen says to encounter such a person with gratitude is rarer than meeting a tiger in the city. He's using a very old metaphor in China for, you know, tiger being, there's obviously tigers exist in China, but encountering an actual tiger in downtown Beijing. For years, I thought what Dogen meant was that the encounter is rare. But it's actually when Dogen says to encounter it with gratitude is actually rare. To encounter it with gratitude is what actualizes and sets it in motion. For although we can encounter reality in all sorts of circumstances, as a matter of fact, it's constantly underneath our feet and before us, what is needed is the actualization of our opening our hearts. There is, some of you might be aware, you know, monks, particularly in our tradition, wear this kesaklep. Okay, and some of you would have been aware of the meaning of it. You know, you have the hook that comes down. It represents the ability of the teaching of the Buddha to be of benefit to us. Okay? Or they say, sometimes they say the compassion of the Buddhas and ancestors, or the compassion of the Buddhas. And as River Master Mann is fond of quoting, she thinks she's quoting me, but in actual fact, it's the Buddhist scriptures. Nothing can be done about this. This is the way it is. The Buddhas and ancestors continually enter the world to benefit beings. One can prove this true for oneself. The ring, which when we put on our kesas in the morning, we connect the ring. First of all, we lay the kesa over both our shoulders, okay, which is to encompass everything within our training, within our commitment to sincerity. And it says also to include all sentient beings. And then when we recite the kesa verse, we move the ring. The ring is what we develop inside our own hearts. Okay? And you notice, the nice thing about Buddhist symbolism is you can stretch it to infinity. Okay, the center is empty. Otherwise, it couldn't hook. Okay? At the same time, there is something there. Okay, so we're not talking about an imaginary thing. There is something that is developed through meditation and through the precepts that is solid. It can be relied upon, but it is not ours. So, because it is empty and open, therefore we bring it across and join it together. That's why actually on the rocks, on the lay minister of rock suits, you have the same ring. Okay? It isn't just a fancy residual of the way people tie their clothing. Or else why would we even do it, if you know what I mean? It is rather that aspect of what we ourselves do. When we give the precepts, it says, the wheel of the Dharma rolls constantly, lacks for nothing, and needs something. Okay? Same thing goes with the symbol that we use of the ship and three drums. You know, which all of you are pretty much familiar with, you know, that stylized character for the heart that goes like that and has three. You've all seen it, I think, or most of you have it because it's on our publicity. That is teaching the same thing. It is based upon a Chinese character for heart, but it's based upon the Sanskrit character or Sanskrit letter for the movement. Oh, I can put it, I won't go into all the aspects of the Sanskrit. What does it lacks for nothing and needs something. What does it need? It needs, in order to be manifest and to be seen, our own practice. And Lord knows, whenever I would hear training in the early days, I had no idea what they meant. You know, I would hear, you know, watch what your mind is doing. I couldn't even find mine, you know, like, or train yourself. Well, how? You know, like, how do I get a grip on it? What does this mean? And I've been at it for almost 40 years. That is, as a monk. And it takes a long time to understand that what we perceive as the Dharma has to be more than something that is out here or up on the altar, okay, or something that we move and brush up against. It has to be something that we actually enter into and practice. Now, when Reverend Master, who came from the generation in Britain of the British Empire and all the things associated with that, most of you being American, I won't explain all the, but basically, when she was going to go to the East, what people said to her was, "Now, my dear, don't go native." Okay? Going native was the cardinal sin. It was all right to study the Dharma. Okay? But you didn't want to lose yourself in it, is the only way I can put it. Because the Dharma represented something that came from inferior civilizations. That's the only way I can put it. And so it was all right to study it, but as I say, but not really to get into it. So the cardinal sin, if I can put it that way, that Reverend Master Jiyu committed, both not only to do with the British Empire, but also to do with the United States and America as well, is to go native. Okay. I remember coming across recently, I won't go into too much detail, it was a woman Lutheran pastor. Okay, it was an interview I saw with her. And very fascinating lady, because she says things that cause one to turn one's thinking upside down, which I always find helpful. And she was being asked about the difference between spirituality and religious, you know, which is a common theme, particularly in this country. And she said, well, if one picks and chooses from different types of religions and spirituality and as to what one is going to practice, one will never choose to do the difficult. She said, people who approach things from that angle would never choose to attend a meeting with a group of people they don't get along with. They would never choose to make their life uncomfortable by looking at something they really don't want to look at. There's a book called The Water Babies that Reverend Master Jiyu was familiar with. It's an old Victorian children's story with an enormous amount of depth. It's about growing up spiritually. And the thing that it says, in order to become a spiritual adult, you have to be willing to go where you don't want to go, do what you don't want to do, and help somebody you would rather not help. Now, when I was thinking about doing this, I was going to summarize what Reverend Master Jiu taught us, or the most essential aspect of it, of precisely that, to be willing to do that which you don't want to do. There's an old poem by Joshu, you know, the great Zen master of the, I don't know, 5th, 6th century. 7th, 8th century, I suppose. Where he says, not wanting to get up in the morning, but getting up. And he does this long thing about the difficulties of living in the mountains. He may be feeling slightly sorry for himself. He says, everybody wants to see a sage, but nobody wants to be one. He also says, people come from the town. They wish to drink tea, but nobody brings any. Now, of course, that has a very, very profound meaning related to what I've been talking about. Yes, the stream of the Dharma and of reality and of compassion flows. But it is we who have to bring ourselves to it. There's a way of explaining merit along those lines, you know, the transfer of merit. We sit and stand with the waters of compassion lapping at our feet. You know, there's that thing of the waveless sea. That's fine. They're there. It's there. But we will not know it, and we will not may be able to make use of it unless we actually generate it, raise it, as it were. Some of you would be familiar with Teresa of Avila, you know, the Christian mystic, her talking about training is like, she calls it the 4 degrees or the 4 waters. Said, initially, training is like drawing water out of a well with very, very great difficulty. You know, you're doing it by hand, and you pull it up. And then eventually you build a little device which gets it to go up. Okay? Little water pulley. And then eventually, you know, you can get it powered. Because as it says, the wheel is hard to get in motion, but once you get it in motion, it is not too difficult to keep in motion. And then finally, she says that eventually it rains. And the water flows down from above. It's a very interesting set of metaphors, and actually she's not actually using metaphors. She's actually talking about what happened. But very interesting to read. For many people I come from Canada, but it's quite similar in many respects and different in others. But many people in practicing the Dharma lay it on top of their lives. Like what do they call those things? A Scandinavian, you know, open-faced sandwich. And you got your basic bread, and then you lay the ham, which we don't eat, but you know what I mean, on top of it. And in order to make training real, it has to be more than something we lay on top of our lives. If you understand what I mean by that. That we take the aspects of training and we just lay them on top of ourselves, almost as if it could be peeled off, to make the training one with ourselves, which is actually what we say in the lecture verse. I vow to make the Buddha's teaching one with myself. How do you go about that? And that was what Reverend Master taught, was how to make it one with oneself, how to go native. One of my congregation members in Vancouver worked as a nurse, and one day it happened to come out of what her practice was. And one of her colleagues said, "Michelle, you're a Buddhist? You know, because you don't resemble one," whatever that means. "You don't resemble one. You don't talk like one. You didn't say anything about it. You didn't tell everybody how many retreats you'd been to. You didn't, you know, try to tell everybody else what to do with their lives. How can you possibly be a religious person? Because isn't that what being religious entails?" And so they were kind of shocked. to integrate, to become one with it, to the degree that it is nothing special. Dogen, in the chapter on Cease from All Evil, says, it is not that there is an evil that we cease from. It is rather there are things we do not do. Okay. And whenever anybody in the, you know, either lay people or monks who have, you know, Kensho or a spiritual experience, although such things can be, you know, wonderful and be very wonderful to be present at, one's greatest concern as a teacher is that it get digested. And I frequently repeat, like a mantra, you have to become an ordinary person. Not a spectacular person. Spectacular people are, as our Master Ji used to say, like Buddhas that sit up on a shelf and you bring them down and dust them from time to time. They're quite nice. They're quite wonderful. They inspire. But you really don't know what to do with them entirely. And also, worshiping other people tends to create a distance. One of the monks here years ago said that the religious idea of having somebody who makes a great accomplishment is that then you don't have to do it. Then you can sort of relax. Say, well, so-and-so's gone and saved the world or whatever, and thank goodness I don't have to worry about that anymore. I can sit back on my haunches. Reverend Master put so much emphasis on that integration with daily life. And one of the disadvantages, in a funny way, of having a teacher who was a Westerner is she never really sounded exotic. And so you could, how do I put it? You would could make the mistake of thinking that what she was talking about was not very profound. If you weren't very careful. To make it true for oneself is not complicated. it's not difficult in the sense of complicated. It's why what we do is called in Japan Farmer Zen, because it doesn't take degrees, or it doesn't really take knowing all about Buddhism. It doesn't really take, you know, being able to study all the scriptures or anything along those lines. It is to practice reality, which is to sit in meditation. And this is the way I put it. Well, all of you would be pretty much familiar with the particular mudra of meditation. Okay, the holding of the hands, one lightly resting on the other and the thumbs touching. Again, like the symbol of the keso clip. These things are not simply done because, you know, somebody in a faraway land used to put their hands that way. And particularly in our tradition, the various forms are held to be coexisting with the truth, if I can put it that way. And the forms themselves can be used to illustrate, not simply as a metaphor, but to illustrate exactly. So, what are you doing when you sit? You're holding everything. Everything without exception. Gently. Everything. When you sit down, you hold everything gently. It's why Tendo, Nyojo, and Keizan say, where do you put your mind in meditation? Put it on the palm of your hand. And then, of course, people think that they have to sit there trying to get that mind thing so hard to find and force it down to the palm of their hand. People are always thus. It means drop, do not pick up, and rest. Do not try to add to, do not try to lessen, okay, by pushing away or cutting off. Hold everything gently. Okay? And then every time your mind starts moving, adding, simply drop it and return. And the mudra of sitting is like a portable Zazen rules. Okay? You carry it about. You carry, this is one of the main things that the Buddha taught, and also Dogen. You carry the whole of the Dharma in, as the Buddha said, in this fathom-long body. Okay? You can practice the Dharma without any text whatsoever by you hold to practice reality while sitting, to hold everything gently. Then when you stand up, practice reality by putting the precepts into practice. Okay? The precepts without meditation can degenerate into a type of form. Okay, oh, I'm not supposed to do that. Oh, I'm supposed to do that. Meditation without precepts can degenerate into simply a form of calming down the mind. Okay? You know, one hears a considerable amount about concentration. And as Zen masters in China used to point out, that's not what it's about. If that's what it were about, people who go to harm other people are very concentrated. They don't have their minds wandering. They're very, you understand what I mean? There has to be the perceptual element of practice. And just as meditation practice of meditation, the deeper one goes, the more there is to it. So the same thing with the practice of the precepts. You know, people often hear them and think, oh yeah, I know about that. And of course, most people hear, and I'm not saying this because I know people, but most people here, generally speaking, are likely to be killing people. You know what I mean? And very few people here have held up a bank recently. Okay, so obviously it's more than that. And again, Reverend Master had a almost unique opportunity to study the Dharma with people who knew what it was about relative to practice rather than to theory. That is why her renderings of the various scriptures, which she did by making use of the already existing translations into English, because she couldn't actually herself translate out of Japanese. She knew a bit of Japanese. They sat down with her in Japan and went through the scriptures line by line to explain not simply what they mean in a translation, but what do they mean when we are going to make use of them to practice, which is an entirely different thing. It's an entirely different thing to translate the scripture of great wisdom from the perspective of knowing the Sanskrit. And it's entirely different to study it from the viewpoint of how does this help practice? And each tradition in Buddhism has a different rendering of the scripture of great wisdom, particularly of the mantra, for that very reason. You know, as I've said before, you know, one of the schools of Buddhism renders the mantra as let's all go together. Okay, that being the Pure Land tradition. Another, I think is the Hosso tradition, says, translates it as the heart that is not bent, the heart that is not obstructed, the heart that is not captured, wider, wider, ever wider. Okay. But if somebody is translating such a thing purely from the scholarly perspective, they get all tangled up in the fact that the tense is wrong, you know, according to classical Sanskrit. That's why they go gone, 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 beyond, when even the scholars know that it does not mean that. I was told that in university by the professor who was teaching me about Buddhism. He said, well, of course it means to go on. It does not mean to stop or to arrive. But people get caught up and get afraid of words and get caught up in, well, we can't move. I must confess, coming from a scholarly background myself, Reverend Master Jiu taught me how not to be afraid of words. I used to be so worried about if I repeated a story. Now, was that Nagarjuna, you know, or was it Vasubandhu who said that, or was it Dogen, or was it Kazan? And I remember the shock I experienced when Reverend Master Jiu used to get them mixed up. She would say, Nagarjuna said that. And I would think, no, I don't think so. And I learned all sorts of things from her, I must confess. And that being one of them, she said, most people look at life from around a corner. And to be very, very careful of people who are afraid of words, because they will not be able to move. They will tie themselves up in knots. They will say, you know, that old thing of the Buddha and being shot by the arrow. Or it could be similar to, you know, people will not get on a boat to cross the river because they don't like the name on it. You know what I mean? Or they don't like the cut of its jib. They don't like the color it's been painted. And I know that sounds silly, but that is in fact what a lot of people do. You know, well, I don't want to try meditation because it doesn't quite... I remember having somebody come to me in Vancouver who argued incessantly with me through the whole of meditation instruction. And I was in those days inclined to explain everything. So, you know, he would say, well, Kaplo Roshi says in, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da that you should do this. And so I would take 5 minutes and say, you know, this has to do with this particular tradition and this is what he means. But it didn't do me any good. The person continually argued with me about every aspect of the blessed thing. And if people are going to do that, there's not much you can do, you know. It's not like we go out and say, if you practice this, you will attain eternal salvation and bliss, and if you don't, you will end up in some nasty hell. It doesn't work that way. In a world, particularly now, those of you who are come from training, started training in the 70s, know how very little there was of places where one could practice and how hard it was to find. I found Shasta Abbey through the Whole Earth Catalog, for those of you who are that old. Access to tools, Buddhism, the internet of the age. Now there's enormous amounts of books. When I first went to Vancouver, there was a single shelf in the bookstore of Buddhism. Now there is like an entire wall. Of course, the question becomes, are we any wiser about it? Reverend Master Jia used to say that people come here, they would come here in the early days for a month and they would write an article. They would come for a weekend and they would write a book. to make it true for oneself is the essential matter. Okay? As it says, the way is not actually difficult. Simply avoid chasing after or pushing away. What I'm fond of is a phrase from that same text, which I sometimes feel in my temple in Vancouver, I sometimes feel like this should be calligraphed and put up on the wall. Only cease to cherish opinions. But then I realize that people don't even know what opinions are. You know, this is the truth, that if you eat this, this will happen to you. The Buddha said that he was talking to a group, a town called Kalama. Whenever I go through Kalama, is it in Oregon or Washington? You drive past it. I always want to go out and put the Kalama Sutra up on their bulletin board. they said, all sorts of people come to the town. They say they're right and everybody else is wrong. How can we tell who is right and who's wrong, you know, in terms of spiritual teaching? And the Buddha said, oh, don't worry about that. Don't worry about trying to determine who is right and who's wrong. When you know, and this phrase of the Buddha gets so misquoted, there's a website called Fake Buddha Quotes. I highly recommend it, actually. They're not rude or anything. But and they don't dismiss the quotes. It's sometimes not the Buddha, it's AA, which is not a problem, if you know what I mean. But and the website itself has these various things like, I never said that, the Buddha. That doesn't sound like me, the Buddha. But in any case, this is one of the most misquoted Buddhist texts there is. The Buddha said, well, when you know for yourself, okay, you notice he didn't say when other people tell you, when you know for yourself Doing this leads to suffering. When you know for yourself doing this is beneficial to self and others. And he includes, which is interesting, he says, don't go by hearsay. Don't go by just because something is written down. Don't go by simply because the teacher says it. He does include in the ways of knowing. He says, when you know that such a direction is praised by the wise. Okay, which is a very interesting means of knowing. Then you should do it. When you know that something, as I say, leads to suffering, you should not. This cuts down what one can know by an enormous amount. When I first started, I had read, as somebody said, swallowed the Buddhist library. So I could quote chapter and verse. The more I go on, the less I can do that. Okay, because I try to stick to what do I know for myself, or what have I explored to a degree enough where I can say, I think this seems to be true for me. And as I said at the beginning, the essential thing that Reverend Master Jiyu taught, and out of which all of this place, and, well, I sometimes think everything I am, down to what I'm wearing, comes out of her. You know, I certainly wouldn't have it. And the whole thing of Jukai and River Master Mayan sitting there holding River Master Jiyu's seat all come out of making it true for oneself. And not spending one's life keeping a distance between oneself and practicing it. All of it comes out of that. Thank you.